Hello, Panic Pixies. We just wanted to let you know that in this podcast, we talk about things like obsessive compulsive disorder, intrusive thoughts, mental health crises, grief, parenting, childbirth, quite a lot of things. So there is a full list of content warnings in the description if you want to read those. The other thing that we wanted to tell you was that we had quite a few technical difficulties with the recording of this episode. It was the first time that we recorded with three of us, and it did lead to my voice being very quiet, which we have tried to fix during the editing, but it has not been entirely successful. So there are a couple of points where I'm very quiet, but it's not when I'm saying anything important, so it doesn't really matter. We have learned from this. So just to let you know, future episodes will not have this problem because we now know how to make sure it doesn't happen again. The other thing that we wanted to say is that we are not doing a Christmas episode, but we do appear on Dr. Kino's Film Emporium discussing our favourite and our least favourite Christmas films. So if you want to hear us talk about Christmas films, do hop over to his podcast, which should be available on all good podcast sites. That's Dr. Kino's Film Emporium. All right, let's get to it. Hello, and welcome to Panic Pixie Scream Girls with Holly and Becky, a podcast about horror and anxiety. And this time we are talking about the 2005 film The Descent by Neil Marshall, who also directed Dog Soldiers. Interesting point of note, it was actually filmed in the UK, although I think the film is based in North Carolina. So Holly, we've actually got a guest today. Isn't that exciting?
Yes, very exciting. This is my friend Kat.
Hello.
We've known each other for gotta be going on 10 years. Mm-hmm. Trying to work it out in terms of life milestones, children raised, you know, that kind of scale. And Kat is very, very smart and funny and also laughs at my jokes, which is the most important thing for a guest. So I thought it would be good to get her on.
Basically, Kat, what she's saying is that I don't laugh at her jokes.
So, Kat, would you like to tell us a bit about yourself?
Yes. hello, my name's Kat. I am a nearly, well, hopefully soon to be qualified social worker. Yes, I'm really interested in mental health from that perspective, I suppose, and from a kind of life experience perspective as well. What else? I have two children. I live in Bristol. Can't think of anything else interesting to say about myself. But yeah, I love films. I'd really know nothing about film as a subject or a kind of academic discipline at all, but I like watching them.
And that's what they're there for. They're not just talked about. So that's absolutely fine.
So I think, Becky, maybe a question about more specific to the horror theme of the podcast and the film you brought with you. So,
yes,
Becky?
We'd love to know what kind of thing really scares you. Like, what are you scared of? What are your fears?
I've been thinking about this like, since you warned me that you would be asking that question. And it's a really tricky one. Like, I don't feel like I have any really particular kind of concrete fears. You know, I'm not afraid of like the dark or enclosed spaces or so, you know, this is.
Oh, that's good.
I don't find this sort of scary at all.
Liar.
I mean, obviously, I'm pretty scared of like how the planet's totally fucked and stuff like that. But I mean, I think most of my fears kind of relate to just personal insecurity, like feeling like I'm not being a good enough mother or friend or romantic partner. I think, God, I feel like I'm going too deep too soon.
No, that's all really good. That's really interesting stuff. So you don't have like phobias, for example.
No.
I have a terrible phobia of spiders. As Holly knows, when we watch films, if there's a spider in the scene, then I have to like not watch, and then she has to tell me when I come again.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, if a spider just jumped out at me, not that spiders tend to do that, then I would be scared, but you know, there isn't really anything that I tend to kind of feel particularly scared of in that way. Yeah, I think if anything, I'm probably not afraid enough of some things. I'll happily kind of just walk home alone in the dark and like not really think about it, and then it's only afterwards that I'll be like, oh, that was probably quite a terrifying situation.
Like, yeah. What would you do if you met a bear?
A bear.
That happens all the time.
Bristol is known for its large bear population. I feel very unprepared for this scenario now.
About that question, Holly.
Oh, sorry. That's
this
a surprise.
Is thinking about more. I mean, I think I would just avert my eyes from it, not try not to meet its gaze, and just, you know, give it the respect it deserves as one of nature's noble creatures. And
Can I ask you, what kind of horror films do you like?
So, I guess, like, generally kind of quite slow, arty, pretentious stuff.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
I'm a terrible hipster cliche. I like quite earnest horror films. Like, I like to get quite immersed in films, especially horror films. I think I like to feel kind of, what's the word, taken out of the narrative flow or something. Yeah, I mean, I'll happily watch something that's just kind of silly and campy and schlocky, but I guess the kind of films that I would choose to watch on my own, or, you know, kind of choose to watch in the cinema, I'd definitely go for something quite arty and pretentious.
Obviously you watch horror films because you enjoy it, so why do you think that you get enjoyment from watching something that's scary?
So I have a history of kind of anxiety and depression, and I think as someone who's kind of experienced quite significant kind of mental distress like that, like had some kind of quite intense mental experiences, that doesn't sound right. Like, I don't know, I think like having a kind of mental health crisis is something that's so intense that you don't often see it mirrored or represented in a lot of media, and I feel like in some ways kind of horror films really mirror the intensity of that experience in a way that other genres maybe just don't. And I think, I know it's a bit of a cliche to say that horror films are, you know, provide a kind of catharsis, but I think there's definitely a truth to that.
Yeah,
I think that's how we feel as well.
Yeah, definitely.
As someone who, like, I experience intrusive thoughts quite a lot, and I think in some ways, like, seeing quite horrible, visceral images on a screen, it kind of externalizes that a bit. It's like, it's almost comforting in a way, because like these kind of images came from someone else's brain, not from mine, so you know,
that's really interesting. I'd like to ask you about that, actually, because so I have obsessive compulsive disorder, and I experience intrusive thoughts as well, and I often wonder whether the experience of watching horror films, because I've been interested in and loved horror since I was far too young to like it. And I often wonder whether that contributes sometimes to some of the imagery that I have and see within my head. And actually, am I making it worse by being into this sort of thing? Or would it happen anyway? And perhaps I would just see different things, but would it still happen? So, you know, I'm not actually making it worse. So I'm kind of always interested in other people's take on that.
Interesting. Maybe a bit of both. Like, maybe it is kind of, you know, maybe it does provide your brain with kind of more material in a way, but then at the same time, I think seeing something represented outside you is such a relief. Like, to know that you're not the only person who has those thoughts or those feelings. Even if it's not a very kind of pleasant experience, I think it still provides a kind of release in a way.
Yeah, I'd agree. And also, for me, I think when you see something horrific played out in the screen, it helps me to separate that I'm having thought, but I would never do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It kind of redraws that boundary between reality and fantasy, because when you're just on your own having those thoughts, you know, they're so vivid and real, it is quite difficult to remember that they are just thoughts. And then kind of seeing them represented as fantasy can maybe be quite helpful.
Because there's something I find quite cozy about watching horror films kind of comfortable at home, because I quite like to read ghost stories in bed as well, is that, like, the dangerous situation is in the TV or in the book, and you're in the safe place.
Yeah.
Yeah, sort of, yeah, there's a reinforcing of the safetiness of home, isn't there?
Yeah.
Mm. It's a kind of a very safe way of engaging with stuff, of engaging with kind of horrific experiences without actually having to experience them yourself.
Yeah, it's kind of a form of exposure therapy in a way.
Yeah, 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 totally.
All right, should we talk about film? We better talk about film.
Oh, yeah. No, let's just talk in like really vague generalizations.
We're talking about The Descent. What is it about the film you like? What's brought you to it?
And what's your history with it?
So yeah, when we were talking about this earlier, I realized I can't actually remember the first time I watched it, which is quite unusual for me, but I think it was maybe just a bit of a slow burner. Like the first time I saw it, it didn't really have that much of an impact, and then it was only on kind of subsequent viewings that it kind of got to me on a deeper level. But I suppose it came out in, it was in 2005, and that was also when I had my first child. So I think the first time I saw it was when he was still quite young. So I think I definitely connected with it in terms of motherhood and, you know, all the kind of fears that come with that. Yeah, I think I'm someone who's quite kind of driven to, like, if there's something I'm afraid of, like, say, you know, as a parent of kind of losing a child, then I think, yeah, I'm someone who feels quite driven to kind of...
to sort of explore that maybe a bit more.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Rather than kind of not thinking about it, I almost, you know, probably go too much the other way and like fixate on it a bit and kind of, you know, every news story, then I'll always have to read it all the way through and, you know, read books about it and watch films about it. And yeah, I think that's just my way of kind of processing that fear.
Yeah, it's a very real and primal fear, especially I think for anyone that gives birth, there's probably like that stronger primal link instinct of protecting your young, which kind of gives you something that you respond to on a deeper level that's probably quite difficult to articulate as well. But I was thinking, I haven't ever given birth to a child, so I don't have that. But I was,
what have you given birth to? a series of ever smaller dolls that fit inside each other.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it works.
That's what my anatomy book says.
Yeah, you have the like the hinge in the middle and you just kind of flip it open and then a smaller and more evil version of you emerges.
Holly, this was the first time you've seen this film, is that right?
It was, yes, thank you. Yeah, it's really good.
I'm so glad you liked it.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I think I just always thought it looked so scary. But I mean, I've built myself up now and I can brave. I'm very brave.
You are very brave. Oh.
And it's just such a nightmarish scenario. And I just was like, I can't spend an hour and a half in a cave with monsters screaming and blood. But like, I just thought, yeah, it was very well done. And it seems oddly resonant now as well, like being like confined to my house.
I know.
You know, this is the cave. We never left the cave.
No.
So meta.
And we never will.
Only in our dreams.
Yeah. So for me, I think it was the third viewing of the film. It is a film I really liked, so I was enjoying the opportunity to get to watch it again, actually. So the basic plot of the film is there's a group of women who kind of clearly enjoy Outward Bound activities. They get together. One of them has recently experienced trauma and grief through losing not only her child, but her husband as well. Then they go and do some caving, potholing, whatever you want to call it.
Splunking?
Plunking.
Going into like a ruin place. And once they're in the small place, they encounter some scary things that live underground that try to kill them. And then there's a sort of subplot of kind of the relationships between the women. And it turns out that one of them has had an affair with the main character's husband who died. So we've got all of that as well. So that's just a summary of the plot for everybody. Hopefully you have seen it, because otherwise there will be spoilers.
Oh, yes.
Although it's directed by a man, which all of the films we've discussed so far have been.
I know, it's terrible.
Oh no.
I know.
Traitors.
But I think that's quite good because we're kind of exploring how men make films and can make good films with women in. But yeah, we definitely need to talk more about films by female directors. But yeah, even though it's directed by a man, it is a film about a group of women. It's quite a feminist film in that sense. The women are portrayed in a really interesting way because they're not just fodder. These are the main characters of the film. It's all about the central relationships between the women. They're not there just to provide background or just to provide a love interest. So we get like a really good kind of female driven film. And you were actually saying, Holly, that it sort of subverts it in a way in the way it treats the one male character.
Yeah, because I don't know if you're familiar with the trope of fridging, which is like in a kind of TV kind of show that the male character's girlfriend is killed and like stuffed in the fridge in a kind of like, you know, Seven type moment.
Yeah.
But it's just that that would provide the catalyst for his journey and his kind of mission of revenge or whatever. The husband is very briefly sketched in. The death of the husband and child is only to propel Sarah's journey.
Yeah.
You know, and the affair serves to kind of damage and lead to the breakdown of the relationship between Sarah and Juno.
Yeah, definitely. And he's almost really important, isn't he?
Well, no.
He's just a narrative driver, which is, as you say, is quite often the role of a female in the film is to be a narrative plot device. But actually, it subverts it in this. Shall we talk about that death at the beginning, which is the death of the child, Jessica, and the husband, Paul, of the main character, essentially, Sarah. It's very horrible, isn't it?
Yeah, I do remember the kind of the impact that had kind of watching it for the first time. There's no kind of build up. Yeah, you're really not expecting it at all. It almost kind of breaks that kind of contract between viewer and film where you're really not expecting. But, you know, it provides like quite an interesting contrast with kind of the deaths that happen later on, which are more kind of conventional horror film deaths. It is like a death that happens in real life. Like it's just completely comes out of nowhere. It's really brutal, really sudden, and it changes everything. And yeah, it just felt so real.
It kind of scared me because I remember, I don't know if you've seen the original Omen film, but there's a death in the Omen where a sheet pane of glass comes off the back of a lorry and decapitates someone. And I found it really disturbing when I saw it because I was quite young and it really stuck with me in my head. And I was always, and still am, a bit scared if you're travelling along the motorway and you're behind any kind of open flatbed vehicle that has something on it like that. And so in this film, it's like pole from scaffolding.
Yeah.
And it's the same sort of thing. And I was like, see, that's why they're dangerous.
That's quite a rational fear, really.
Like if I was driving behind one, I would go into the other lane. I wouldn't go behind it.
I don't blame you. I'm learning to drive at the moment and I just think cars are terrifying and like people don't think about how terrifying they are enough.
It's you're driving a death trap.
just a big weapon, like driving around.
And the worst thing for me about driving is that no matter how good you are, you can be the best driver in the world, you can't account for other people being an idiot or doing something good, and you've got no control over that, which is terrifying to me.
I thought it was interesting. It shows a lot less than you think it shows, which I think is clever.
Yeah.
In terms of like the pole and the girl, that's like you don't see that pole decapitate her or whatever, but you see you see the trajectory and you see, is it from outside you see blood on the window or?
But your brain always fills in the gaps, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Actually, it's much more awful what you think in your head than what you actually see. So what about what we were saying before, basically, that this is kind of Sarah's journey. So she's going through a journey of having gone through this tremendous trauma. And then she kind of reconnects with her friends to go through this fun weekend.
Fun.
Yeah, fun weekend. Not everybody's idea of fun. I love it, but you would hate it, Holly. So, you know.
What's wrong with a city break?
Noted.
You could have just sat in the cabin and...
I suppose.
With a book.
Made dinner for when everyone got back.
Yeah. Oh, no. Imagine Holly waiting for all the, like, the entire cast of The Descent to come back and she got dinner ready.
Just sitting at the table with a whole lasagna crying. Yeah.
Sounds like an average Friday night.
Yeah, too close to home, that one.
Lockdown life.
So yeah, she's going through this kind of this grief story arc. And what do you think the film is telling us about the experience of grief and trauma?
I think it depicts the cyclical nature of grief and trauma really well, about how, you know, because it's only a year, I think, in the timeline of the film, it's a year. So the events of the film take place. The caving expedition takes place only a year after Sarah's kind of lost her husband and child. And yeah, I suppose just the way that you can think you've dealt with an experience like that, and you feel like you've been through this whole process, and then actually there's more, there's like another whole process to go through, and you can't skip a stage, like you just have to keep kind of going through it.
And she does kind of go on a metamorphosis through the film,
I guess. Yeah, I kind of interpreted that as being kind of her more authentic emotional state, maybe. And
yeah,
I suppose you don't really see very much of her in the time before she went through this kind of massive bereavement and trauma. You know, during the caving expedition, in the initial stages of that, she does seem very kind of, you know, almost absent, and she kind of, you know, has a certain like lack of effect. And yeah, I suppose I just saw emotional state seems to kind of disintegrate so quickly, like from the minute they get into the cave. It's almost like you can see the kind of cracks starting to show.
Yeah. I liked how it kind of showed you don't have to hide or suppress these powerful emotions to be like strong and resilient. Because she seemed very meek and kind of self-effacing, and then everyone else was kind of tiptoeing around her and trying not to upset her and stuff. But then she gets her revenge and gets to safety, we think, for a bit. We'll talk about that later. But, you know, she sees this vision of her daughter at the end. So, like, her loss is still with her, but she's amazing. It's a kind of almost primal state.
Yeah, there's a really, really great scene, actually, where she goes into a sort of a cave and there's lots of the creatures and she kills loads of them, and then she just kind of emerges from this pool of blood. She's really kick-ass and she's like, yeah, I can do it. And it's kind of like that sort of moment of regaining yourself, isn't it? And kind of getting back to you.
But then the way that you almost, you have to completely lose yourself and disintegrate sometimes to kind of, but to find yourself, you know, to be yourself, to come through that trauma and kind of find that resilience. It does involve like a certain kind of
breaking yourself down.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Or just abandoning that need to kind of please people or meet people's expectations or kind of, you know, meet social expectations. You just have to kind of let all that go and just swim around in a big
from a
pool of blood.
It reminded me a bit of Carrie at the prom.
Yeah.
Just how like the kind of staring eyes and kind of flattened down hair, and that she's just like, I have had enough of this bullshit. Oh, hell no. You know?
And I think there's something that you can relate to from that feeling as a woman.
I mean,
something about
me?
That. Yeah. And, you know, this is probably going a bit too far, but there's also something about the blood that, you know, the female state, and that sort of like fuck you kind of bit. I was just like, yeah, I get it.
You're just gonna splash around in a big pool of my own menstrual blood. It's got to be done.
I saw it more in terms of like rebirth and stuff, because she's kind of like she's giving birth to herself, you know, and then when she bursts from the earth as well, that's another kind of Carrie moment, which is like her hand, she's kind of clawing her way out of the ground. which turns out to be a dream, which is complicated, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah, maybe. There was so much kind of, some of it slightly on the nose, but imagery in there. You know, there's obviously the struggle through the long kind of tunnels. There's the big pools of blood. And I thought the brawlers, they have a kind of sort of quite fetal look about them as well.
Interesting.
Yeah, that kind of half formed, sort of very pale kind of, yeah.
Should we talk about them actually? The
Claws? Yeah.
They're the kind of central monster of the film, but they're not really a monster. So I was reading before that Neil Marshall chose to make them humanoid because he felt that that was more scary than having something that's alien. Having something that's slightly human is actually more terrifying, which I definitely agree with. And they are very effective. They are really creepy.
And I felt like, you know, the special effects side of that really hasn't dated at all. Like it, you know, because it is, 15 years old now. That film,
and don't see them a lot. Like, they do it quite well. You see bits and stuff before you actually really start to see them, so you're really brought into it by the time you actually get full reveal.
I read this interview with Shauna McDonald, who plays Sarah, and she said that the main crawler guy, on like the last day of filming, he had this skateboarding accident when he was in full makeup and had to be taken to hospital. Still in, and like they could, so he broke his ankle, so they had to take him to hospital. And he was still in full makeup, and all the nurses were just like freaking out.
Oh my God.
But they couldn't take it off because he was like writhing in agony.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
It must have been a fun day at work for everybody.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, dear.
So, like, the central conceit we think of the monsters is they're some kind of colony that lives underground, subterranean creatures, humanoid creatures. And he purposely made them so that there's male and female and babies, so you can see that they have been living and growing and stuff.
Well, there's like one lady crawler.
I thought that was stupid because, I mean, I wrote that down because I was just like, with long hair and breasts.
Yeah, I know.
Because, if the male ones don't have hair
any
on them
hair,
anywhere,
then, yeah,
any hair.
It doesn't make much sense.
No.
Yeah, it was kind of lazy, not lazy writing or lazy art direction. I don't know.
It's almost like Ms. Pac-Man, isn't it? Just put a bow on it.
How can we make it look like a lady? Or let's just give it long hair and boobs. Did it have boobs?
I'm for that. I agree with that. I mean, obviously I'm for boobs, as Holly knows.
I mean
boobs in movies.
Preach into the choir here.
All about the boobies.
But, you know, they have babies, so they need boobs to feed the baby.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. But do they need hair?
They didn't look like kind of dogs, did they? They look like boobs. They look like someone is.
Hey,
stuck
stop
to
body
boobs.
Shaming the crawler.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I thought that scene was. I don't know. I felt like it was necessary because I almost felt like, you know, the female or the woman crawler. The female presenting crawler was kind of really necessary. Felt like she was kind of Sarah's shadow aspect because she's a kind of mother who fails in the narrative of the film, kind of fails to protect her child.
That's a really good shout. Yeah, it's a strong echo there.
Yeah, and then I think that scene comes just before the pool of blood scene as well. But yeah, I don't know, even though I felt like the scene needed to be there, at the same time it did feel a bit tacked on, and there was just like one mum crawler and one baby crawler. Maybe all the others just, I don't know, maybe they're not allowed out or something.
They should be in school.
maybe the women and children crawlers are all just like super civilized and they just like an actual society and they just banish the men to like the upper regions of the cave
and just hang about being murderous.
It's accurate.
Sounds like a utopia. So did you find them kind of scary, Holly? Did they have impact on you?
Yeah, because I think it's the relationship to human. It's kind of the uncanny. They're like human, but not quite. And are they subhuman? Are they superhuman because they're incredibly agile and fast, and then they can kind of find their way around in the dark by echolocation? So they're kind of like perfectly adapted to their environment as predators. And they also blind and don't speak or have language. So they're kind of quite animalistic, but then they're also very well-evolved predators.
Mm.
You said something really interesting about a potential reading of that in terms of maybe, we'll dance with this briefly, the colonialist.
Yeah, I guess I did briefly want to touch on the aspect of this where, you know, they are a bunch of mostly white women kind of coming into someone else's home, essentially, and just kind of stamping around and making a load of noise and killing their children. I thought, you know, I don't necessarily feel kind of equipped to explore that in any great depth, but I feel like, yeah, we should, you know, mention that there's a long history of a bunch of white explorers kind of going into someone else's home and making a mess. So
definitely. And kind of previous kind of racist racial theories and eugenicist theories of like degeneracy and genetic degeneration of humanity, or certain people being less than human, you know.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, it's obviously very disturbing. And there's and that's been used in a lot of horror actually as well.
Yeah, definitely. If they are supposed to be, according to the kind of narrative of the film, they were at some point human or possibly still are. Yeah, that's kind of quite troubling in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, those women have just turned up in their home being made of food. I mean, for them, you know, this is a kind of Deliveroo scenario. They're like, hey, who ordered the pizza? I mean, well, I mean, if it's here, we might as well.
Really not to.
Yeah. Oh, it'll only go cold, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you really don't see them attempting to store this meat in any way. Do we? It's very much just like eat it all now and then all the bones in a big pile.
Oh yeah.
Maybe they get a lot of traffic going through the case.
Yeah, like a really surprising amount. Lots of deer in those caves.
I think there is something about how they probably don't need to eat very often, like they sort of have food stores.
Oh, like snakes.
Yeah, like they can just eat occasionally and then, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I think I may have got that from The Descent 2. Which Holly hasn't seen, but Kat and I agree is not a good film. But I think they go more into the sort of like nitty gritty of the monsters and like how they evolved and stuff within that film. But it was kind of quite bad, so I don't really remember. I didn't commit it to memory.
Yeah, I tend to pretend it doesn't exist.
It's not canon.
No. We have decided that it is not.
So should we go back to humans now?
Sure.
And talk about the women. So, you know, obviously because the majority of the cast, the central characters are all a group of women, there's a lot about female relationship. Some of which annoyed me a little bit. When we were talking about this beforehand, the three of us, we talked a little bit about the fact that why does it have to be that the tension, which is necessary between two of the characters, is brought about by one of them having an affair with the other one's husband? Like, why does it have to be that? Couldn't it be something else? It is quite a good narrative plot point. It does work because it provides that reason why they don't like each other and why there's an issue.
I'm not sure it's as simple as them not liking each other, because I feel like Juno almost has this real like fixation on Sarah, like this real kind of need to make amends.
She's definitely guilty.
Yeah, because her whole motivation for kind of taking them to this unexplored cave system is because doesn't she say, I thought we could explore it together and we could name it after you to Sarah. And
yeah.
Like, wow, that's really full on. Like, your friend just took you to an undiscovered cave system and was like, I want to name this after you.
I mean, sure.
Like, what? Like, just Sarah Caves doesn't have a it doesn't have much of a ring to it, does it?
Well, and also Sarah expresses that she felt that Juno didn't support her after her bereavement.
Yeah.
But I guess that kind of makes sense because she also said we all lost something in the crash. Like
yeah,
because she'd lost her lover. Was grieving as well, but
of course, that kind of
makes sense. Yeah
and it's kind of
she's gonna feel difficult, isn't she, about like rocking up and offering support when she was sleeping with her husband. I mean, it's not the most comfortable situation.
That's a bit of a head scratcher. And it's kind of a shame, you know, they're both grieving the same person, but they have to do it completely separately and kind of I thought the way it played out, you know, with the kind of final fight scene was just kind of ridiculous. And I think that's, to me, that's like the weakest. To me, that's like the weakest point in the film is when they have that final showdown. Yeah, it wasn't great.
Well, because also we know that because Sarah thinks that Juno has attempted to murder their friend Beth and left her for dead. Whereas it was actually a terrible accident.
Yeah, a really unfortunate.
A really, really, incident. Yeah, a real, you know, bummer. A blooper, a right, you know, just my bad, you know. Yeah,
that it was an accident and that she didn't mean to pick at her in the neck. Right, I get. That. But she did run away and leave her, like.
Well,
I don't care if she was all stressed out about it. She still left her for dead.
I felt like that was such a real moment, like such a human moment. Because it's not the way that people usually behave in films, but that is the way that lots of people behave in real life. Like, it's like she's so ashamed of what she's done that she's just like, I'm just going to run away and pretend it's never happened. It just seemed like something that would happen in real life. Like, it just seemed like such a normal human reaction to this awful thing happening.
I mean, that's true. And in reality, when people are in shock, they do often run. That's a key part of shock. So I guess, it is real. But I still, I think, you know, I don't like her.
It's because the film doesn't want you to like her.
Yeah, it's true.
This is not caving. This is an ego trip.
And did you say, Kat, you felt there was like, Beth has some kind of obsession or fascination with Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about obsession. She seems like she, you know, maybe fancies her a bit. I don't know.
You sense some chemistry?
yeah, maybe it's a bit one-sided, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just felt like all her motivation was kind of protecting Sarah in various ways. And we don't really know much about her other than she's Sarah's best friend.
I thought Beth gets fridged for Sarah as well.
Oh, it's a real fridge-a-thon. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Double whammy.
Double fridgy. I don't think we've talked about this yet. This film is super queer. I don't know. That's my hot take.
Just outdoorsy gals being outdoorsy pals.
There's no harm in it.
There's nothing overt, but it's definitely a film that you can respond to on a queer level. I think that's fair.
Yeah. There's that bit about Holly being, not you, Film Holly. About Film Holly being Juno's protege, isn't there? That I thought was quite...
Oh, funny. Yeah.
They kind of exchange meaningful glances and it's like...
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Protege.
So it does explore like relationships between women, which it obviously will, because it's a film with lots of women in it.
Yes.
There's something about, you get to see a myriad of different dynamics, which is really great. It definitely passes the Bechdel test, which we talked about before, I think, on one of our podcasts, which is quite important. It's like, in order to pass that, there needs to be at least one scene where there are two women talking and they are not talking about men.
And they have names.
And they have names. As long as that is happening, it passes the test.
Yeah.
Now that you know that, next 2-3 films you watch, see if they pass the test, you'll be surprised how many don't.
Oh, so depressing how many don't.
I think it has the kind of queer vibe of almost like, you know, those kind of homoerotic kind of male buddy movies.
Yeah.
It's like a buddy movie.
Yeah.
Queer vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just the like.
But everyone dies.
The kind of the group, the outdoorsy, the peril. It's like all like very intense and charged and physical. They're all very, you know, the proximity.
Didn't you say, Holly, that you felt like, although it is a film about a group of women, it could easily also be a film about a group of men?
Yeah, I think so. But I think just because we're so unused to seeing characters like these that are female, the groups of female friends, it's not a cat fight. They're not constantly talking about men. They're not very stereotyped. They're actually doing stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something I like really respond to about the film. Mm-hmm. I was trying to articulate this before, and I was saying, which did make both of you laugh, that it's really good kind of seeing women do hobbies.
Yeah.
Hobbies.
Yeah. What I mean by that is that normally we see women as a romantic interest or a narrative plot point, or we see women in the workplace or women as mothers, but actually seeing women going and doing an activity on their own together as women is not something that you frequently see within movies. So that's actually something that I really responded to, and particularly as somebody who does enjoy outdoorsy activities myself, I really
do.
Like
you
that.
Though
yeah, I do. I don't like caving. I know that you don't like outdoors activities. I don't like caving.
No.
I'm not claustrophobic, weirdly, but I'm scared of getting stuck.
Okay.
Yeah. So like, I don't mind enclosed spaces. I'll go in an enclosed space as long as I know I can get out. But I don't want to go in a cave where I might not be able to get out.
No, that's fair. That's totally fair.
I guess caving is technically indoors.
Yeah.
Yeah, true.
No, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know exactly what you were trying to say. It was just the image of like just being slaughtered by a bunch of kind of monsters in a cave as being a hobby. So what do you do in your spare time? Accidentally kill my friends with a pickaxe.
Yeah.
You say before, Kat, that it was sort of about there's like cooperation but also like competition between them.
It was a pretty kind of half-baked thought, but I thought it was interesting. You know, Holly, when you were saying about the casting being almost kind of gender blind, I was actually thinking like, would a group of men have kind of cooperated in quite the same way in that situation? I feel like there would have been more kind of posturing maybe and more kind of
That's true. Because there was more in the way of negotiation and listening.
Yeah. Although it does get them all killed ultimately. So
yeah.
What we take from that. But and I suppose maybe we do get a bit of that from Juno actually.
That's interesting because
showing off almost.
Machismo. Because the thing is, and then is this a problem because like she's the most masculine, quote air quotes, in her behavior, and also she's the only woman of color as well.
Yeah, I know
that's unfortunate.
Yeah, possible.
Yeah, possibly. That is a bit. That is not great. I mean, I thought film Holly was quite kind of.
Oh, that's true. Oh yeah, she was like little Juno.
Yeah, Juno's protege.
Protege.
I feel like I want to call all my sexual partners my proteges from.
Podcast Holly said that she liked the fact that there's, because Podcast Holly doesn't like outward bound activities.
I go outside.
Yeah, sometimes. Like, have a nice little walk sometimes.
Sometimes. Yeah.
I've been known to.
But you said that you liked the fact that there's a line that says, "We've got to get Holly out of here." And you were like, yes, we do.
Yes.
Yeah, that scene where film Holly breaks her leg. Oh,
my that's God. Horrible. Yeah, it's really graphic.
Yeah. I don't know how much worse it is to break your leg in a cave than to just break your leg outside a cave.
Yeah. Like,
everything is just so heightened because they're just trapped underground.
Well, and I think it just shows, because it's also kind of badass because she's like in agony and that they're trying to like having to poke the bone back in and she's just like, just do it. You know, like, whereas like in a typical film like this, like a woman would like probably just twist her ankle and be like, I can't, it's gone without me, or just get a bit tired.
Break a nail.
Yeah.
Fall over a branch.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do we want to talk about, actually, because now you've brought it up, the extreme kind of graphicness of seeing the broken bone, the kind of aspects of horror that you see within this film? So there's quite a bit of body horror and horribleness. What else do you
Yeah, that's observe? Not even the worst incident. No, it's not. I think, oh gosh, I can never remember the names of the two sisters. The younger sister is the doctor or a medical student.
Oh, okay.
And then there's the older sister. You know, there's a scene where they both kind of die in very quick succession. So the younger sister tries to get back across the roof of the cave, and then she kind of gets ambushed by the crawler in the middle. Like kind of mid-climb, so and then ends up like dangling upside down, just kind of spurting. Her older sister, she just kind of pieces out a bit, and she's like, oh fuck this, and she tries to get back down the tunnel, and then she just gets basically eaten alive by a bunch of crawlers.
It was really horrible.
It is graphic, but it's not graphic. Like, it's graphic in terms of the content. And yes, there's a lot of spurting of blood, but in terms of like the actual physical what you see, it's not actually that graphic.
I think the sound does a lot of work.
The sound production is there's a moment where I think it's Holly gets her throat torn out, and you just hear this like this scream that turns into a gurgle. And it's like, it's so bad. It's just I don't think I've ever seen like that level of kind of gruesome yet realistic detail in many other films. I don't know, it's so much worse than if she was just screaming and then it stopped. It's like she's screaming and then you hear it kind of turning into this like
And then there's the claustrophobia of the caves and the tunnel collapse, actually I found incredibly stressful.
That's really one of the scariest moments. I think if you are
claustrophobic, it's probably a really difficult film.
I suppose I'm not like super claustrophobic, but I wouldn't go in a cave, you know, like that. I wouldn't go down a tunnel like that.
I don't want to.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, you quite like enclosed spaces, don't you?
I suppose I like a nest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blanket nest.
Yeah, yeah, blanket nest.
Yeah, like a fort, blanket forts, and
yeah.
There's quite a lot of jump scares as well, aren't there?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so glad I didn't see it in the cinema because. I was just too scared to see it for years and years because just the idea of it and the trailer, and I was just like, no way. But I'm really glad I saw it.
Yeah, imagine ushering for The Descent.
I used to be a cinema usher for many years, kind of art house cinema. So then I saw a lot of films, but generally mostly French films about people having affairs. And with Kristen Scott Thomas. She was in everything, apparently. Yeah. But we did have a couple of horror films.
I remember when they had, what's it called, the Holocaust film, Son of Saul?
Son of Saul. Oh yeah.
I remember you were like, finding that really rough.
Yeah, they had to like draft a policy for like difficult films and ushers. Everyone was just having breakdowns over it. You know, if you're working a lot, you could easily see something like 3, 4, 5 times.
That would be so rough.
I think I saw it 2 or 3 times, but I knew when the worst bits were and I had to step out, take a breather, because it was just like, oh, it's too much.
Is there anything that we, because I think we've touched on it, but I just want to check, is there anything we want to say about motherhood that we haven't talked about?
Yeah, I feel like that's just such a strong theme in this film. I like the intensity of parenthood and motherhood, of, you know, being the parent who kind of gives birth in particular, and just how hard it is to articulate that experience or kind of relate it to anything else in life, because it's such a primal experience. It's not really like anything else in modern life. I think it really kind of depicted just those very raw, sort of unappealing emotions that parenthood can produce, like, very accurately. I think, you know, so much of what Sarah has to process is this kind of shame and guilt that she's feeling at not having protected her child. And I'm certainly saying that in a totally non-judgmental way. Like, I don't think that she's failed to protect her child. I just want to make that clear. But, you know, she's obviously carrying a lot of shame about not having done that.
You're the only one of us.
I know. Birth, like, so. I'm the token mother. Yeah, I suppose just how difficult those experiences are to explain to other people, to explain in words, because, you know, obviously motherhood and parenthood are a huge part of of kind of just social discourse in general, but I think the intensity of those experiences gets quite glossed over.
Oh, definitely. And I think there's something, sort of having worked in healthcare quite a bit, obviously, about your body and yourself, your mind as a woman actually blocks out a lot of the horrible stuff that you go through. So a lot of people don't really remember what it was like. They do, but they don't, because your brain has kind of protected you from the actual trauma of giving birth.
But then I sometimes wonder how much of that is just we don't give people who give birth the words to, or the space to express that experience. You know, and maybe because that's how we process, as human beings, that's how we process experiences, is by kind of putting them into words and communicating them to other people. And if we're not given the tools to do that, then it never really gets processed in the same way as other experiences, maybe.
And I guess something about shame there generally, in that, you know, it should be this natural thing, everyone does it, you know. Well, not everyone does it,
not everyone.
And I certainly have no intention of doing it, just to be very clear, anyone listening that knows me. But I think sometimes women feel it's difficult to talk about the difficult stuff around mother and around birth, because people think maybe we shouldn't talk about that, we should hear it. And I always find that kind of sad, really, because I think that's the rounding of any experience. It has good sides and bad sides. And I think if we talked about it more, it would make it easier for people to come to terms with things when they do go through trauma.
Yeah, and easier to connect with others who've had similar experiences. You know, the same could be said of grief and death and bereavement and all that as well. But, you know, birth and death, they're both kind of experiences that are very sanitized and in modern society, and they're kind of kept away from public view. And they kind of happen in kind of in secrecy. And yeah, obviously this is a film with a lot of death in it as well. So
very mild death. It's certainly not mild peril, is it?
No.
Heck in peril.
So I think the last thing that we should probably talk about, which makes sense to be the last thing, is the ending, which is bleak, isn't it?
It's so bleak. Is it?
Or is it? Yeah.
Well, because it's annoying, because we know the Descent 2 has Sarah in it, so we know that she does survive. And Juno, I believe, you said.
Yeah. Also. I don't think spoilers for Descent Part 2. I don't think Juno doesn't make it all the way through the second film. I think she like nobly sacrifices herself in some way.
How did she fix her leg?
I don't think she does. I think she just kind of is still really good at fighting, even with like a totally shattered thigh.
So like at the end, Sarah survives. She gets away and we're like, oh my God, thank God she's gone through it. Well done. Mm. And then there's some kind of like hallucination-y type part where it was all a dream and actually she's still back in the cave, but it's not really clear.
It's very ambiguous. I think it's very open to interpretation, even if you pretend Descent Part 2 didn't happen, which I tend to do. Because, she kind of bursts her way out of the soil and then she's like running, covered in blood, like runs to the car, drives like wildly down this dirt track, and then she stops the car and kind of vomits. I think you see Juno in the background. She almost pops up like a little kind of J horror. I'm pretty sure that's, unless I'm remembering it wrong, but I'm pretty sure you see Juno kind of behind her.
Yeah, there's a monster in the car, but I can't remember.
I think it's Juno.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't think it's a crawler.
Yeah.
I might be wrong. But and then
you might be right there.
And then it kind of cuts back to Sarah in the cave. Kind of back in the cave, like, and she's having this hallucination of her daughter kind of holding this birthday cake, and you can hear all the crawlers still screaming in the background. It's kind of, she's never left. But I think it could just be read either way. Like, it could be read as her escape is a hallucination, or it could be read as her return to the cave is a, or the fact that she never left the cave is a hallucination, because the cave is inside her.
When I first watched it, I definitely took it quite literally to mean that she hadn't escaped, and I was really depressed by the end.
Yeah.
I thought she'd made it.
Yeah.
I feel like the scenes of her escape are quite gritty. You know, they're not like, if I was fantasizing about escaping from a monster cave, like, I probably wouldn't fantasize about stopping the car and like throwing up.
No.
So, I don't know. I feel like there's a realism to those scenes that makes me feel that it's not completely cut and dried.
What about you, Holly? Where did you lie on it? Did you think she got out, or did you think she's
still there? But then that was the first time I watched it, so I was probably being literal as well. But I've always thought, like, she was, you know, rehearsing it in her head, you know, her escape, and so it would be real.
Does she want to escape? Like, I almost feel like she doesn't feel like she deserves to escape. I don't know.
Like, she's not fully come to terms with everything, so maybe she's not ready to leave the cave.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I've said this before, but, you know, I think you can definitely read the whole cave system as kind of representing Sarah's unconscious or hurt or her kind of her unprocessed trauma. So obviously, even though she's kind of physically left the cave, she's kind of still there mentally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or something.
I mean, are we supposed to feel it's hopeful that she has that hallucination of the daughter? And the birthday cake, is that hopeful? Is that...
I don't know. I mean, it's such a powerful image. It's so...
Yeah.
It really gets to me, that image. It's really tragic. And I don't know. I guess there's like the whole birthday cake kind of rebirth metaphor. So I don't know. Maybe it can be read as like Sarah's rebirth.
I see it as like that's her comfort. You know, this is her time of peril. And that's her happy place. Her comfort is a nice memory.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's definitely some very dark... readings of that as well.
So another thumbs up from us. A good film to watch.
Terrifying and brilliant, intense.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity to watch it again and to talk to you about it, Kat. We loved having you.
Thank you.
Yay, I did a podcast.
Yay!
Oh my God, I was so scared. I should have said my greatest fear was doing a podcast, being a guest on a podcast in the beginning. thank you for having me. I had a really great time.
So thank you very much for listening to the Panic Pixie Screen Girls. You can find us on Twitter at Panic Pixies, Instagram at Panic Pixies, and on Facebook at Panic Pixie Screen Girls. Do come and interact with us. We love hearing from you. And if you've got any suggestions of films we should talk about, let us know. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you very much for listening. This was Panic Pixie Scream Girls by Holly Parsons and Becky Lewis-Jones. Editing by Gareth Lewis-Jones. Please do rate, review and subscribe. It really helps other people find our podcast, and we'd really appreciate it if you'd pop a rating in, because it helps us be seen. If you didn't like the podcast, you can just ignore that bit though. Don't bother. It's all right. And also, from the Panic Pixies, we just wanted to say, if you celebrate Christmas, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And because I'm Welsh, Nadolig Llawen a Blwyddyn Newydd Dda. See you in the new year.